Good afternoon and welcome to Living Permaculture on KDNK. I'm your host, Vanessa Harmony of Colorado Edible Forest Plant Nursery in Spring Valley of Glenwood Springs, Colorado. Myself and my co-host, Jerome Osentowski of Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute in Basalt, Colorado, are thankful for all our wonderful guests over this past year. Sometimes our conversations ran longer than we could allot time for on the air, so this month I've made a compilation of previously unaired clips from three past guests' interviews. Let's start off with this one for my interview with the Executive Director of the Women, Food, and Agriculture Network, Julianne or Jules Salinas, and also my mentee in the Women, Food, and Agriculture Network's Harvesting Our Potential program, Amber, aka Stormy Kennedy. So what is a conservation burial ground?
So conservation burial ground, again, spooky season, so we can talk about it. conservation burial ground is different from a conventional burial ground. So very, you know, like we talked about a food system, similarly, our death care system is completely distracted or completely torn away from what it originally was, you know, hundreds of years ago, where we were really connected to the cycle of life. And conservation burial grounds really bring that connection back into a full surface. And so instead of being embalmed, you're not embalmed, the bodies are just cared for naturally, the bodies are just washed and then, you know, wrapped usually in a shroud or sometimes in a biodegradable casket, like a bamboo or a wicker casket. They are placed buried into the ground without a vault. What a lot of people don't know is that in a regular, quote-unquote, traditional cemetery, which is not traditional at all, has these cement walls that are placed into the ground, and then the casket is placed into those $15,000 caskets are placed into to the ground with these cement walls. And then they're covered up, and then they bring in, you know, Italian limestone for the headstones. In a conservation burial ground, there are no vaults. There's no, just you go returned right to the ground, and then you are covered up. And then the only headpiece at this Casper Creek, that's the name of it. But the only headstone is a locally mined piece of limestone, only on one side, and just words that it lays flat with the ground. So it's very unassuming. It's not like these big monuments or anything like that. And then it's all prairie restoration. Everything is just prairie restoration from there, and trees. You could have agroforestry and prairie restoration. It's just gorgeous, the prairie restoration that they're doing there. And it's all former farmland that has just been donated to become conservation burial grounds.
Wow.
And so now this land is forever endowed into this Casper Creek Conservation Burial Ground in Joe Davies County, Illinois. It's gorgeous.
Cool.
And it gives me hope for the future of green burials here in the Midwest.
Nice. Yeah, I would like to be composted, whether after a burial or just like actually in a compost pile.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, that's also that's an emerging practice. Sorry, we were totally getting away from harvesting our potential, but that is kind of a harvesting our potential.
It definitely is.
That's the ultimate harvesting our potential. Mm-hmm. So for me, that is like heaven on earth to get recycled into billions of other organisms.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, harvesting our potential, and actually all the programs at WFAN here, I'll wrap it around. Really is about creating mycelium, of creating a network of, you know, people that can connect together and really help each other out and support each other who have traditionally not been supported and given that kind of support. So, you know, mycelium is everywhere, and I think that that's something that we need to grow and support and encourage.
Now let's reflect back to mine and Jerome's two-part interview in July and August with New York Times best-selling author David Lipsky, whose recent nonfiction book is entitled The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial. If you were writing a fictional sequel to this book, would it have a happy ending?
Wow, what a great question. Yeah, I think it would, but it's not especially an earned happy ending. I think that there's a part of us that is moral about our consumption of technology. So I was reading an old play by Aristophanes this morning, as a person will when they wake up. And it's the play called The Clouds, where Aristophanes is sort of making fun of Socrates. But in the middle of that play, there is an argument basically between the old generation of Athenians and the coming up generation. And the old Athenians are saying that the new technology is making the young Athenians soft. And in this case, the new technology is hot baths. So that we do tend, and so the older Athenians are saying, you guys have to avoid those hot baths. They make your brain soft. And so, and they even had greatest generation notions the way we do. So they're saying, look, the generation that fought in Marathon, that was a great military win by the Athenians, they didn't need hot baths. So you are softening your brains by taking these hot baths. So that we do, I think that we have I think we have mixed feelings about the way that that technology makes our lives easier and somehow takes the morality out of them. Now, sometimes we can be crazily wrong about that. Tolstoy, a great humanist, he believed that giving anesthetics during childbirth was wrong because he thought that people should experience all of the pain and all of the physical sensations of this a few times in a lifetime moment without any mediation whatsoever. So sometimes we can be wrongheaded about that. But in general, I think that we get anxious about the great deal sometimes that technology offers us. And so we believe that, like in the Rumpelstiltskin story, that there will be some price that we have to pay later. And so there's a part of us that on some level is satisfied by the idea of the fact that, you know, this party couldn't go on forever, that we couldn't have cities that are lit up so you can see them from space. That we couldn't have high-speed rail the way we still don't have it in America, but the way that some of our trading partners have it, that we couldn't have digital technology so good that something that Tesla dreamed about at the turn of the last century is in every grammar school kid's pocket, which is a way to communicate with anybody on any point of the globe instantly. And some animal part of us believes that that is insupportable and there was always going to be a price, that hot baths are bad. But I think, in fact, for example, you know that the last year or two, especially last year, has been the first time that America has had good news on emissions. The rest of the world, you know, we have 12 years to cut our emissions globally by 45%. That was the IPCC communicated that to us in the fall of 2018. And, of course, not surprising, we are up 4 or 5%. We have not begun to make those cuts. But America's emissions actually were down last year.
Really?
And one reason they're especially down is that we have radically cut our use of coal in the generation of electricity. Around 2005, 2006, about 51% of America's electricity was generated by coal. And coal is the dirtiest fossil fuel in general, but especially for climate change, for global warming. As of last year, it was down to 19% of our national electricity was generated by coal. Do you know what made that possible?
No.
Fracking.
Ooh.
That's what I mean about the morality. It is just a question of equations and technology, so that we might have a happy ending just because AI or technology may work the way my friend was so disappointed to find that our leaders are counting on it. And the part of us that hates foolhardy behavior might almost root against that. But there is, you know, there's every chance that we will get a happy ending that we don't deserve as creatures and as stewards of this planet. What do you guys think?
Well, we're staying in the garden and working at small and slow solutions. So,
yeah, I see the happy ending every day because it all works. My systems work. It's just amazing to go out into a 20-year-old food forest and see all the interactions with the plants and the animals too.
And the soil.
How everything just kind of flows if you create this amazing environment where everything's reliant on everything else. Every day is a happy ending, actually. Yeah.
I think that's beautifully said. I do. My sense is that there's the best thing that we can hope for is an unearned happy ending, because all of the solutions, the agricultural solutions that we've been talking about this afternoon, they are thrilling and they are deeply satisfying, but we also have to bring in 7 or 8 billion of our neighbors and both instruct them on this and also get them to understand why it's important. And for better or worse, as you both know, the history of environmentalism in this country, it has always been, it's a narrow cast as opposed to a broadcast. I think that on some level, most of our neighbors don't care about the beauty. They are not satisfied. Like you were talking about the open corridor on your land. Is it 2 miles? Did I have that wrong? But that was so beautiful. I was visualizing, you know, I will watch video. People will sometimes put up sort of ring cameras on those kinds of animal corridors because animals, when they find a path, they'll keep traveling it. And it's thrilling and satisfying to watch. But I think that most people would probably just prefer a good subway or, you know, universal Wi-Fi to our responsibility to the creatures that we share the planet with. And so that's what I mean, that there's every chance that we'll get a happy ending that we don't entirely deserve. But the idea that we would get a happy ending that we earn by the kinds of strenuous and imaginative and intelligent husbandry of the land that you're talking about, Jerome and Vanessa, what do you think that the odds are of that?
Well, it'll be a slow path. It just, we're working with one person at a time, one customer at a time, changing their spirits to make change from within to without to have their effect on the world.
Yeah, patience, I think, is probably what we need to practice. And, you know, I think...
I totally agree, but Jerome and Vanessa, like, we also show that what the IPCC has said is that we have to cut our emissions by 45% as of 2030. And they said that in 2018, and we're halfway there, and we have, planetarily, we have gone up 4%. And then we have to bring it to net zero by 2050 so that there isn't time for that. That's something that we can do once we have it down to net zero. That would be something that we could do after. But I don't know that we could convince... Is your sense that you could convince people of that very intelligent way to approach husbanding the land? Do you feel that that would work on an international scale, that you could institute it in roughly a 25-year period?
Well, if we had the resources that the other side has to do all their denial, yes, and we could package this. You know, if you want to, if that's what's going to take, we'd have to package it and promote it with all the forces and all the money that they're using to deny it. I'm just curious, like, you know, the papers and the news is just full of climate catastrophes right now.
Hurricane Beryl.
I mean, that last hurricane that went through Grenada, you know, I'm a sailor, and, you know, Grenada, as far as I remember, it was where you took your sailboat and the hurricanes never hit. And that barrel just leveled it, and then it went through Jamaica and hit the Yucatan, and then it flooded Houston. So this is one hurricane. And what's been happening all summer in the Midwest with tornadoes and people still don't get it, right? And the heat wave, right?
I think they do get it. And I think that they are willing to pay that price for being able to drive in 3 or 4 hours from New York City to Washington, D.C., that they're willing to pay it until it gets really, really bad. And I think that was the great victory that the deniers won, which is that had this data been absorbed the way President Bush wanted it to be absorbed, and this is something that people like Professor Oppenheimer, not related to Robert Oppenheimer, but Michael Oppenheimer, who is a who's an ecologist at Princeton. He said that had we acted around the time that the first President Bush wanted us to act, we could have kept this to a few warmer days in March. But we didn't take action, and now it's here. But the weird thing is that we have had devastating things like Beryl and like the fires last summer, and people have had time to absorb it, and so far they're basically okay with it. They have basically agreed that, you know, we can have summers that are stiflingly hot. Like New York City, we have had a run of 85 degree plus days for about a month, and it was shocking to me when I was going out to jog this morning. It was like, wow, this is like mid-August, and it is early July, and it was like mid-August in early June. And so what we've agreed, because we had so much time to get used to the idea, we've agreed that, okay, we will pay for this with terrible summers and with terrible hurricanes. We'll pay for things to be okay the other 9 months of the year. The problem, and it was great, Vanessa, when you were leading off with ozone, is that we don't know what the cumulative effect is. So that with the ozone hole, Jerome, it's a fun chapter in the book. The understanding was that we would eat up the ozone layer, which is just like the SPF that the planet is wearing, that we would eat it up and it would slowly cause more skin cancers. But what they didn't understand is exactly what would happen as you began to eat up more ozone. And so what actually happened was there was a giant hole in the ozone over Antarctica. The hole eventually became, first it was bigger than the continental U.S., then it was bigger than Antarctica, which is the biggest continent. And that was just unforeseeable. The equations didn't predict that, and it was so disturbing that within 2 years, what had been an intractable problem, how do you outlaw, how do you ban chlorofluorocarbons? How could you rule them out in every economy in the world? Once you saw that, wow, there's a giant hole in the atmosphere that we couldn't predict, then it just took 2 years to hammer it out. But if the hole had built over a 40-year period, which is basically what's happened here, I think people might have been able to accept it. And that's what we've chosen to do as a people with this. Again, we don't know if you have summers this bad. We actually don't know what that's going to do to growing seasons, right? Just no one's done it before. And so it could be that 5 or 10 years from now, there will be some add-on effect that we couldn't predict. But it seems like otherwise, as a people, internationally as a people, we've decided, I guess this is okay. We really like having cities that are bright all night, and it's wonderful to have Wi-Fi. And so that we're willing to pay this price and to have all the other living things that we share the planet with, to have them without them voting. We've agreed, all of us have agreed to have them pay the price too. That's what I mean by we might get a happy ending, but it won't be one that we earned.
Well, we're along for the ride.
Finally, let's revisit mine and Jerome's interview in February with Claude Jolicoeur, where we discussed cider making and cider tasting, and Claude's book, The New Cider Maker's Handbook. Can you try to describe the taste and experience of drinking a superior award-winning cider?
Yes, this is a difficult question, but the best I think I can do is to tell you, as a judge in many international competitions, what I'm looking at and the things that I do for evaluating and judging a cider. So there are really 4 points that we look at. So let's just enumerate the points first, and then we'll go a little further. So we look at the appearance of the cider, the nose, the mouth, and the overall experience. So the appearance first is, I think a great cider should have some color. The colorless cider, for me, indicates a cider that doesn't have much interesting flavor. Great flavors come with some amber color, sort of goes together. It should also be well clarified, in my opinion. I like a cider that has been clarified. It means that the maker has taken some interest in producing something that looks good, haziness in general is not as well perceived in a competition. It might lose some points. Second point is the nose. We do seek a complex aroma that is well present, and naturally it should be a pleasant aroma, not too funky. Funkiness usually indicates that the cider was contaminated with some unwanted microorganism that may produce some off flavors. The third point is the taste in the mouth. So here we're going to evaluate the balance between the acidity, the tannins, and the residual sugar. So some ciders may be overly acidic. Some others may be cloying sweet. Others may be really super bitter without the sugar to balance the bitterness. So there are balance that we need to have there. Also, we want the cider to have a structure. It should be mouth-filling, and it should give a sensation of persistence. In other words, you want the flavor to remain in your mouth for a long period of time after you've swallowed your sip. For example, the flavor of ciders made exclusively from eating apple tend to vanish very rapidly after drinking. So you're seeking for more persistence in that. And the fourth point, the overall experience, is that what I call the wow effect. So sometimes when you have a great cider, it just makes wow. So there's nothing else to say.
And then the whole subject of ice cider. I remember there was a tree next to our deck. It's a full-size tree. I don't know what variety it is, but one year it had smaller apples, and we didn't pick it because we had so many apples. And it was a bird feeder for the entire winter. So we just had these crazy birds going. I think they were getting drunk because they were getting the apple juice from the frozen, and it was so much fun to watch them going, you know. And we have a partner, Michael Thompson is my partner in ecosystems design, and he's a cider maker, and he makes apple cider, ice cider. He'll go out of his way to let the apples freeze on the tree on some of these old orchards, and then come back and make a special batch of ice cider.
Personally, when I make ice cider, I tend to pick my apples in fall and leave them in a shed outside, you know, just to protect them from the animals, but they freeze there. But I still have some that are hanging in the tree, so I might pick some of those also. We'll see.
That sounds like a great
but,
winter activity.
Freezing does completely change the flavor profile of the apple. And I also make a cider what I call winter cider now, which is sort of a cousin of ice cider, but it is not as concentrated at the start, and it is much drier. It's almost dry. Hmm. So, but it does have the flavor change that are brought by the freezing. And this flavor change, it's because by freezing and unfreezing and refreezing, what this makes is that it breaks the cells from the skin of the apple. And then all the polyphenols that are in the skin migrate into the juice, which you don't get when you just press an apple in fall.
Oh, interesting.
So all these flavor components from the skin, you get them in the juice from an apple that has frozen and thawed and refrozen.
Wow.
And the sugar changes completely the flavor.
The sugars concentrate as well. I wanted to mention that.
Yes, but you don't need to seek that sugar concentration to have the flavor.
I visited a cider orchard in Port Townsend, and what fascinated me about this was it was a traditional semi-dwarf orchard, fenced about maybe an acre or 2 acres, and they ran geese to mow the grass and fertilize the orchard. And there was a bar there, a cider bar. They sold it in bottles. There was a restaurant there. There was a whole bunch of different agricultural activities on this property. I can't remember there. It's Aspen something.
That would be Alpenfire Cider.
I'd love to get, my fascination is taking things that are in monoculture and then start adding different components to them, in agroforestry. One of the ones that's been fascinating recently is called Syntropics. Comes out of Brazil. So you could actually take a cider orchard and add all of these other components to it and add a lot of diversity.
My orchard is you'd call it semi-wild, I have some islands of diversity everywhere because there were rock piles, lots of rocks where I live. So when I started the orchard, there were rock piles, and in those rock piles there's all sorts of diverse vegetation, wild raspberries, and blackberries also.
That adds to your integrated pest management, so you get more flowering plants.
I do zero pest management, I have zero pest management. It's not integrated. This is really zero.
Yeah.
Letting nature do it.
Yeah. Well, if you're in good balance, you don't need to do so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's all a question of balance. Yeah. So if you have a complex, a lot of diversity in a complex ecosystem with lots of species, different plants, you have much less chance that some bad, nasty thing gets control. But if you've got a huge monoculture of some acres of the same thing and you don't even let the grass grow, some bad stuff gets into that and zaps the whole thing in no time. I don't have to tell you that. It's the basis of what you're doing. Permaculture is simply based on...
Yeah, that's kind of our hallmark.
Thanks for listening to this month's compilation episode of Living Permaculture on KDNK. Tune in for another episode next month on the third Monday of the month at 4 p.m. I'll talk to you then.